You're listening to another top-rated show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia. I'm your host of the American Hour with my co-host, Paula Lozon Ostman. How are you doing today, Paula?
I'm doing great. How are you, Tom?
Excellent. You know, the weather here today in Florida, South Florida, is very similar to what it was when I was just down in Brazil. I was in Rio, and we broadcast the last two shows from there. And I thought that the last show in particular yesterday with Mark Ross went really well. And, you know, we talked about what really is a conservative. And I think he did a good job of laying out his case for the different types of conservatism. But I got an email from him, let's see, I don't remember if it was this morning or last night. I guess it would have been this morning, saying, hey, Tom, why don't we do a follow-up called What Really is a Liberal? And I think, hey, that's a great idea. What do you think of that?
Yep.
So we'll have him back, and we'll let him get time to prepare that all together, and we'll talk about it, but we'll have him back and talk about what really is a liberal in any case. So anybody that wants to go back and look at any of the past broadcasts, if they go to usatalkradionetwork.com, I've got a list, and go to my page for the American Hour on the network there. On my page, it lists upcoming guests, and down below now I've moved the past guests to the bottom as previous guests, and you can see the dates, and there is a link. Basically, click anywhere on that area, and it'll take you to a page that gives you all of the broadcasts. You can stream any one of those right then and there, or you can download via iTunes, so you have those two options. So we had some great shows back on the 8th with Franz Cabreau, who I consider the most influential non-elected conservative in the state of Florida. Paul Skousen, who's son of Cleon Skousen and wrote the 5,000-year leap. You heard Mark Ross refer to the 5,000-year leap a couple times yesterday on the show. Then we had Kelly Townsend from the Greater Phoenix Tea Party Patriots on Tuesday. That was the 12th. So we got some good shows, and then there's a few shows in there that I broadcast without having any guests on there, and we talked about current events, and kind of like what we're going to do today, we're going to talk about what's in the news, current events, and today is tax day. I got a very
Happy
nice email.
Yeah.
Did you get your taxes in, Paula?
I believe that the accountant did get the taxes in, yes.
Good. Well, I filed an extension because I've been so busy lately that I really – it's easy for me to do if I just take the time, so I don't believe I'm going to owe anything. So I called my accountant and said, okay, let's do an extension. Because quite honestly, if I don't get him the stuff about a month in advance, he does an extension anyway because he's so busy, so tied up. And this is a guy who specializes in people in the travel industry. If you're on a cruise line, airline, or train system, Martin Kapp, out in California. You don't have to live there. I don't live there anymore, but he does mine long distance, and boy, saves me a lot of money. So, he's grown so much over the years that unless I get it to him early, then it's going to be an extension anyway. So at least the extension's in. I'm covered there. But so today's tax day. I got a nice email from you this morning saying, happy tax day. I don't know if there is any such thing as a happy tax day. Is there?
No, there isn't. We weren't as fortunate this year. We had to pay in, so.
Oh, yeah, that's a pain. I mean, I've had to do that in the past, and that's how it goes. But let's talk a little bit here about upcoming guests. Now, Sunday at 3 o'clock on the USA Talk Radio Network, Ed Ross is kicking off his show, The Ed Ross Show. He's got a very interesting background with the military and the government, and he knows a lot about national security. I'm going to be on his show as the guest on Sunday. So it's this Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on The Ed Ross Show. Just go to USA Talk Radio Network and look for The Ed Ross Show. Click on that, and you can hear us talking there on Sunday. Then we've got Nick Taxia coming on. He's a political satirist, and he's got one of my favorite websites called the duhprogressive.com. And every time I go there, I just laugh at some of the stuff he puts together. I like satire, and he does a good job of poking fun at liberals So if you're a liberal, you might not like it as much, or maybe you will. I mean, I laugh at some of the jokes about conservatives and Republicans, too, because, you know, if it's something funny, it's funny. But then on Tuesday, we've got Joan Flowers. Her father was a World War II veteran, and the Clinton administration promised him a burial in Arlington. And I've got copies of the documents that she received from the administration and other elected officials back then, and it never happened. And then Clinton was out of office at that point, and she's tried working with other administrations. She's even been told, and I'm going to get the name of her representative. She's been told by her congresswoman that, sorry, there's nothing I can do to help. It's not, you know, within my realm to help you, which is not true at all. Not true at all. In fact, just so the people know, on Monday, I'm going to be meeting with my congresswoman and a bunch of other veterans for a veterans advisory board meeting. You know, if you want to be accessible as a congressperson, you can be accessible to your constituents and you can do things. You can't help every single individual out, but when there are important things. So here's an example. We are forming a veterans advisory board under, you know, her direction. She's going to let us run with this thing. When things like this come along, she, number one, has a veterans advisor on her staff. But these are the kind of things that can be sent to us because we have the expertise in working with the VA, in working with state and local legislators. You know, the veteran service officers within any given state are paid for by the counties. They go county by county. There are a lot of things that veterans know, and people like myself and many of these other veterans that know a heck of a lot more than me because they've been doing it for many years, about the process of veterans benefits, et cetera. So she's relying on us to use our expertise. So this is why I'm saying it's a total baloney that this congresswoman in Chicago is telling her, no, there's nothing I can do. I'm going to bet this congresswoman doesn't have a veterans advisory board like Congresswoman Sandy Adams. And I want to plug Sandy Adams because I'm proud of her. She was one of the 59. Remember yesterday, Paul, you said just in the House passed the not continuing resolution, but the budget for the rest of the year. Wasn't that yesterday?
Yeah, it was yesterday. Compromise budget, yep.
Yeah, that it just passed. Okay. Well, and then you also told me that there were 59, though, that voted no. And we knew that the numbers were probably going to go up of disgruntled or unhappy, you know, we're being scammed here, Congress people. Sure enough, Sandy Adams, District 24 of Florida, voted no. I'm going to be seeing her Monday morning at this advisory board meeting, and I'm really going to be happy to see her and shake her hand and thank her for standing up to the establishment and the kind of deception that was played out on the American citizens here with this 250 million dollars. What a joke. So, and the other thing about Sandy is her colleagues in Central Florida, and I'm going to call them out, John Micah, and I don't remember his district. If it's district, I don't want to even guess, but I know Bill Posey, District 15, and Daniel Webster, who's a freshman congressman, but he is an establishment guy. He was an elected representative at the state level before that. They all voted yes. They all voted with the establishment and voted on a bill that was a scam on the American people. So my hat's off to Sandy Adams. Thankfully, I now have a good Congress member representing me, unlike what we used to have. We worked very hard to get rid of the past incumbent who never formed a veterans advisory board, was not the first time she ever met with a large group of veterans. I was not there, but many of my friends were, and they said, she stood up and said, listen, you have to understand, veterans issues are not the top priority in Congress. Wow. How to win friends and half of the guys got up and walked out. We all understand that. No, we're complete morons, and we don't know that veterans issues are not the number one issues facing our country right now. But my gosh, it is an issue for us, and we can help you manage that issue. But no, her attitude was so there were just too many veterans in District 24, and you can't be a representative in District 24 and diss the vets, or you are not going to stay in office. And that's pretty much what happened. I mean, that was part of it, big part of it. But in any case, so Sandy Adams, if you want to find out more about Sandy Adams, District 24, go to sandyadams.com. You'll find a link to her congressional site. I don't know what that is. But in any case, okay, enough about that. Let's see, where were we? Well, we were talking about upcoming shows. Joan Flowers, and that's where we got off on the veterans thing on Tuesday the 19th. On the 20th, Susan Bradford. Susan Bradford. You don't want to miss this one. She wrote the book Lynched, and it's about the Jack Abramoff scandal and what transpired. And it's very interesting. I'm going to pull up the press release that I haven't put out yet for her, but it's here's what the book says, or the copy for the book that's promoting it. It says, Lynch reveals the extent to which separation of powers in the U.S. system of justice are under assault by liberal special interests, including those aligned with billionaire financier George Soros. That's part of it. The other thing is how Democrats, the Washington Post, and Indian gaming tribes in Florida conspired to set up Abramoff. He didn't really do anything illegal, but they conspired with discussions and emails and other things to make it look like he was conspiring and got him in trouble. So, he was a lobbyist. He was a wealthy lobbyist. People don't tend to like them. But so anyway, we're going to get the scoop from Susan. She's been in there. She spent a lot of time researching the book and coming up with a lot of documents and interviews. She did, I think, conducted something like over 400 interviews with people for this book. So I think it'll be an interesting day and interesting discussion. That's the 20th of April, Wednesday, at 4 p.m. Eastern. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about that? You looking forward to that, Paula?
Yeah, I am. I am. I did a little background research, and she's, you know, sounds interesting. I'm looking forward to hearing from her.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like anything, there may be – I haven't done enough research to find out if there are critics out there. The only critic I could find was somebody that didn't – wasn't critical of anything specific, just said, you know, investigative journalism, we can all make it look, you know, spectacular, blah, blah, blah. Well, do you have anything actually specifically critical of her book? No, of course not.
Cool.
So, yeah, that's critics that don't have any specifics. I have no sympathy for them, and I don't even want to listen to them. And then Friday the 22nd, which is Earth Day, and I think this is a perfect day to have Winston Scott on the show. He was an astronaut. He's a retired NASA astronaut, and we're going to have him on Earth Day. And he'll be calling in around 4:15 Eastern. We'll start the show at 4. And we're going to talk about NASA. The whole show is going to be about NASA. And we're going to pick his brain. Go ahead, Paul.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's going to be all about NASA, what's going on, where it's headed, where he thinks it ought to be headed, what he thinks could be done, and I'm going to put out a lot of press to Central Florida and the Space Coast, the folks there that I know, because I think there'll be a lot of interest to listen to him, because NASA really impacts Central Florida and the Space Coast and ultimately all of Florida. So we'll see how many callers we have in there, but I know we'll have lots of listeners. So,
good.
And then Kathleen McKinley on the 25th. She's a soccer mom. Well, I don't know if she's actually a soccer mom, but she's, you know, a conservative mom in Texas who writes a political blog for the Houston Chronicle.
Okay.
And then my good friend Dion Long, the 28th of April. This guy's an expert on the gold standard and the fair tax. We'll talk a little bit about that today, but Dion really knows how to explain it. He spent a lot of time researching it, read many books. He was not convinced to begin with when he first heard about the fair tax, but he said, and he'll tell us a story, but after reading a couple books, and he'll tell us which books they were, he was absolutely convinced, and I am too. I believe in it, and I believe that's where we need to go. You heard the commentator today. You sent me, Paula, a link to, was it CNBC? And they had, who do they have on there? It was David Walker on the Squawk Box, former U.S. comptroller. Yeah. And they were talking about the debt ceiling and some other things. And he started bringing it, and toward the end he was asked, well, what's the solution? And he started talking about some different things. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But Dion Long, he really knows this stuff well. Now, he's a lawyer. He's not a personal injury lawyer or anything like that. He works mainly on, I think, copyright and other types of law like that. But he's a really sharp guy, and I think everybody will like him. And he's a good friend of mine. So I look forward to having him on the show. All right, so that's upcoming shows. And again, go to usatalkradionetwork.com. Go to my page there, and you can get a link to all of the archive shows and, of course, see what's coming up. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, it's the American Hour on Twitter. On Facebook, it's the American Hour Radio Show. And, Paula, go ahead with your Twitter account.
My Twitter account is @MegawattQueen.
Yeah, Megawatt Queen. I'm just going to write that down, because I ask every time, and I kind of know what it is, and I've
Don't
got you on
it.
My list, but I never want to say it wrong. Megawatt Queen. All right, I get that written down. Great. So, yeah, go there and check out. You've got all kinds of great posts about the energy sector and what's going on with there and future energy, and we're going to come back to that, because I pulled up you probably heard that Governor Brown in California has said that
yes.
they're going to require 33% of energy renewable by 2020. So
yes.
if he has a good plan for it, that's great. I lived in California for 15 years, so we'll talk about my experience with their mandating energy stuff and how well that worked in the past. And he has been a past governor. Of course, he wasn't at the time, but we'll come back to that. But let's talk about tax day a little bit here. And
okay.
I'm gonna go back in history to about 1801. And this
mm-hmm.
is from a book that people have heard me talk about before, written by Henry Adams. It's the History of the United States from 1801 to 1809, and it's essentially the two administrations of Thomas Jefferson. And I not only have read this book, but I go back and read it. When I'm thinking about something that I remember reading and that may have even highlighted, and I go back and read it again. It's a very thick book. It's about 1,250 pages long, so it's not necessarily an easy read, but I find it very intriguing, and I go back and I find new stuff all the time. But here is Jefferson's annual message, which in 1801, which was he did not actually give to the legislature; he just wrote it out and then passed it out to them.
mm-hmm.
He didn't want to speak to them, and that had been the tradition of the two previous presidents. Now, people have to realize Jefferson was our third president. This was Washington had two terms. So 8 years, and then Adams had a 4-year term. So we're talking 12
mm-hmm.
years, 12 years into the history of our nation under our current Constitution. And as the author of the book is sort of recapping and talking about a portion of it, he says, and this is Henry Adams, assuming the states themselves have principal care of our persons, our property, and our reputation, constituting the great field of human concerns, the message, in his annual message, maintained that the federal government was unnecessarily complicated and expensive, and that its work could be better performed at a smaller cost. And that was the thrust of his part of his annual address. So here we are in 1801, and we've got Thomas Jefferson saying the federal government is unnecessarily complicated and expensive. Wow. Nothing has changed. In fact, I bet he would have a heart attack if we could even bring him back to life. He'd have a heart attack to see how unnecessarily complicated and truly expensive it is today. Now here we go on with what was in part of the message, and this is Jefferson writing. Considering the general tendency to multiply offices and dependencies and to increase expense to the ultimate term of burden which the citizen can bear, it behooves us to avail ourselves of every occasion which presents itself for taking off the surcharge. Now, the surcharge back then was a surcharge on goods, on your property. There were no income taxes back then, and income taxes weren't allowed. But surcharges or direct taxes on goods and property, that was what was allowed. But he didn't want to have any, and for a long, long time we didn't have any. We'll talk about the 16th Amendment where we came up with the income tax. But so I'll back up. Avail ourselves of every occasion which presents itself for taking off the surcharge, in other words, eliminating taxes on people, that it never may be seen here, that it may not easy to read, that it never may be seen here that after leaving to labor the smallest portion, so what he's really saying is that nobody in the future can say that we've left labor the smallest portion of its earnings on which it can subsist, while government itself consumes the residue of what it was instituted to guard. So that was an issue. That's one of the reasons that Jefferson got elected in 1800, is because of states' rights and state sovereignty was being trampled, they felt, by the federal government. And the federal government was grabbing too much power. Well, nothing's changed. That's how a lot of people feel today, that the federal government is getting too big. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I want to read one other part after that portion of his speech or written speech. His Secretary of the Treasury, Gallatin, his name was, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right, Glatton's economies turned on the question whether the national debt or the risk of foreign aggression were more dangerous to America. Freedom from debt and the taxation which debt entailed was his object, not in order to save money, but to prevent corruption. I thought that was a really interesting comment, that they knew that as a young and nation without a big military, whether it be Navy or, and they really didn't even have a Navy, but they did build up a small Navy and small army, that they were at risk from being attacked by France, possibly Spain and France, definitely England, and at sea they could not control the seas if England wanted to shut them off and shut down their harbors. But they didn't see that as a bigger threat. What they saw as a bigger threat was debt and taxation that would turn into corruption and then feed on itself. And this is exactly what we're seeing today. We're seeing a federal government that feeds on itself and has an insatiable desire to grow and take more of our money and property. And so that's what they were concerned with, and they did eliminate all surcharges and direct taxes. The only money that they were bringing in, and that revenue increased more than they ever imagined over the next 5 years, just from imports and exports. And the reason is because the private business people were and entrepreneurs were able to have the freedom to grow their businesses and go out and go travel to other islands in the Caribbean and grab resources, bring them back, then ship them off to Europe. And the shipping business grew at a very fast rate and brought in a lot of money for the U.S. So here's a perfect example. When people say, oh, smaller government and less taxation doesn't mean a better economy. Well, it sure did back when there was virtually no economy in a very small country. It grew quite quickly. So there's a perfect example of how getting government out of our lives and out of our business does help the country grow and enrich people. So that was from 1801. And then there was a couple other things that caught my eye in the same area. And so this is around the time of his annual address. But the author, Henry Adams, says the essence of Virginia republicanism, and that's what got, that's the kind of republicanism which was strict constructionist of the Constitution that got Jefferson elected. The essence of Virginia republicanism lay in a single maxim: the government shall not be the final judge of its own powers. Now, where do we see that going on today, Paula? Can you think of some things where we see government the final judge of its own powers?
Within the government itself?
Yeah, well, what I'm thinking about is when the federal government and the Supreme Court start ruling that states, nope, you don't have that authority. Nope, this is the authority of the federal government. Nope, you can't do that. Nope, can't do that. Nope, you can't do that. Nothing that has to do with the Constitution, but it's the government has become, the federal government has become so big and powerful that it is now the final judge of its own power. We, the people, aren't the final judge. They have become the judge of their own power in coordination with the all three branches. They work together. They are the final judges of their own powers, and that was something that Jefferson warned against, and I've read it in other places in this book and seen it other places. And here's what the author, and this the author is the great-great-grandson of John Adams, our second president, who was a Federalist and believed in more centralized government. And that's why he lost, because the states felt that he was infringing, that the federal government was infringing on their sovereignty. But here's the great-great-grandson talking about this. He said, the liberties of America, as the Republican Party believed, rested in this nutshell. For if the government, either in its legislative, executive, or judicial departments, or any combination of them, could define its own powers in the last resort, then its will and not the letter of the Constitution was law. So I read this because we feel like things have gotten out of hand in the last, and you hear people say, 50 years, 100 years. This has been a problem. This has been a problem since 1800. And it's probably going to be a problem that we're always going to be battling. And there are some solutions, I believe. Some of them are a combination of legislation and a couple amendments to the Constitution that clarify. But the other thing that I found that was rather interesting was a discussion of some of the enumerations in the Constitution that, again, we feel like they're a problem today, but it was a problem already back then. And here the author goes. He says, certain phrases in the Constitution have been shown by experience to be full of perils and were so well established by precedent. So this is 1800. There has already been precedent established of being susceptible to, you know, generalization. For example, the clause which gave Congress sweeping power to make all laws which a majority might think necessary and proper for carrying the Constitution into effect was, as settled by precedents, fatal not only to the theory of states' rights, but to the doctrine of strict construction on which American liberties were supposed to rest.
Mm-hmm.
There we have it. There's 1800, and it's already a problem, the necessary proper clause. How about the war-making, the war and treaty-making powers with their undefined and therefore unlimited consequences? Were well understood. Those loopholes for the admission of European sovereignty into the citadel of American liberty were seen in 1800 as clearly as when the children and grandchildren of the Southern statesmen broke up the Union because they feared the consequences of centralization. Everybody thinks that the Civil War was over slavery. It was over government centralization and too much central power in the federal government, too much power in the central, you know, federalized government. So I thought those things, a lot of people may say, Tom, you're boring me, you're putting me to sleep. I'm just trying to point out, nothing has changed. We're facing the same problems when it comes to adhering to the Constitution that even our founders did. Our founders fought over these things. They put it together, and there was an intent. But as time went on, it's that old adage, power corrupts. So some of our most respected founders over time, and you and I talked about this earlier, Alexander Hamilton, who helped write some of the Federalist Papers, making the case for a limited federal government over what we had prior in the Articles of Confederation, which was absolutely no power, so it was too close to anarchy. After we had a constitution, he became a huge centralist, and as I was telling you earlier, Paula, he talked about how much he disdained democracy. He wanted to eliminate democracy. He wanted to position the northern states, such as Massachusetts and New York, et cetera, in a position to secede and create a new government and organization of states without democracy. The government would be in total control. Sounds more like a monarchy to me, but that's what he wanted to do. And so there were a lot of perils back then with our Constitution, even with our founders. So we know what the intent was and what they said, but once they were in power, things began to change. And as Mark Ross said yesterday, there was no belief or intent or idea when the Constitution was written and then the government was formed that there were going to be a couple parties, but people started splitting directions pretty quickly, and we ended up with two parties, two main parties right away, the Federalists and the Republicans. So that's sort of the history of a little bit of taxation and the federal government. But let's talk about today. In fact, let's talk about the 16th Amendment. You want to start off? You want to talk a little bit about that, Paula?
Oh, I digress to you, Tom.
That's okay. I sprung that on you in the last minute, so you don't have to worry about that. But the 16th Amendment simply says that the Congress can levy an income tax without apportioning it among the states. Now, people are like, well, what's that mean? Well, prior to the 16th Amendment, any kind of tax that was going to be levied on the states had to be apportioned, which means based on their population. If you had a small population, then your taxes would be lower. And then the other thing was, it was a tax generally on the value of your property. So if you were a landowner, you would pay based on the value of your land. If you weren't a landowner and you had no property, you paid no taxes, even if you were earning money, even if you were earning good money. So that was the process back then. Over time, it started changing, and we can look at a few things here. Like after the Civil War, there was a lot of debt to pay off, and the Revenue Act of 1861 was a flat tax of 3% on annual income above $800. So, and that would be equivalent today of about $19,000. Then the act was replaced the following year with the Revenue Act of 1862. Which had a graduated tax of 3 through 5% of income above 600. So it gradually worked its way up. So this kind of went on, but then there were some Supreme Court challenges that said it was unconstitutional to have direct taxes, whether it be on somebody's property or income, et cetera, without apportioning it. In other words, saying you're a smaller state. So let's say you lived in a smaller state.
Mm-hmm.
And your taxes would be lower than somebody in another state. So they would be uniform taxes, but now I may be wrong about that. Your taxes wouldn't be lower, but what they couldn't do is tax a state at the same rate as another state when they have less people. So it has to be apportioned according to their census. Okay. So now what the 16th Amendment did was it came along and essentially said we don't have to apportion based on the census data. Just every single person making money, we're taxing it. And we can tax property and everything else, not just income. So the terms income used to be indirect, called indirect taxes. And direct taxes were taxes that went on a specific piece of property. So the indirect taxes, and prior to the 16th Amendment, you couldn't tax indirect taxes. So income couldn't be taxed. It had to be property, the value of your property. So now the 16th Amendment kind of abolishes all that. We can tax your property. We can tax your income. We can tax anything. And we can tax it at whatever rate we want, and it has nothing to do with the census, the size of the state, the number of population in any state, all that. So it pretty much got rid of all that. Now a lot of people would say, well, that's a good thing because we need the federal government to have money. Well, remember the quote that I read from Mr. Gallatin, the Secretary of the Treasury for Thomas Jefferson? He was more concerned about corruption. And he said, it's not in order to save money by not having tax on our people, not taxing our people, and not having debt. It's about preventing corruption. So the 16th Amendment has done a fantastic job of opening the door to a massive amount of corruption, in my humble opinion.
Yep.
And
no,
that's why we need a simplified system. And this is what Mr. Walker got at today when he was on the show. Let me pull that
squawk
up again. Box. Yeah, the squawk box. I know you. I don't normally watch that because I'm either. Does that come on in the morning?
It does come on in the morning, and believe it or not, my husband watches it with my son, and I had come downstairs and I was watching it, and I went, oh, I gotta tag this one. It was really good.
Yeah. No, it was good. And, I'm usually either asleep because I came in, like this morning, actually, we were late. I'll tell you about that in a second. But it would have been like 4 o'clock in the morning. I get home, grab a little bite to eat, and lay down for a few hours. So I miss that kind of stuff in the morning. And then on days that I'm flying out late at night, I sleep in. A lot of guys will get up in the morning and then take a nap in the afternoon. Once I get up, that's it. I'm done. There's no such thing as a nap. There's too much to do. So I kind of miss that stuff. But that was good. I'm glad you saw that. And so what David Walker, the one thing about David Walker is he's a little bit, I thought, a little bit wishy-washy in terms of, well, he liked Paul Ryan's presentation.
Yeah.
He also liked Obama's presentation. So it's kind of like, well, they're, to me, on opposite ends. But what he's doing is he's picking certain parts out and likes certain parts of each one. What did you think of his responses?
His, the anchor, the news anchor, had called him on the fact that 46% to 47% of the Americans do not pay income taxes, which I was not aware of.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a difference between paying the income taxes and the regular, what is it, the VAT tax? Is that what you had?
Yeah, the value added tax. Well, let's talk about the value added tax because a lot of people don't understand what that is.
Value
added. If you go to Canada, they have a value added tax.
They have
a value. Go ahead. What's that?
They have all sorts of taxes. They got
they do.
The VAT.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Well, their taxes, I believe their value-added tax plus their regular sales tax adds up to something close to 20%. And I'll look that up. I was going to look that up today. My wife is from Canada. I should know it, but they keep going up. But the value-added tax, here's the bad thing about a value-added tax. And so he talked about it, and even the commentator said, well, what about it? And he said, well, yeah, maybe a value-added tax. But then he said something about a flat tax, and then he said something about a consumption tax. He said a flat tax wouldn't work. No, a flat tax will work if there are no loopholes whatsoever. But the problem is this, and we talked about this a little bit, I think, yesterday or the day before. If I'm a millionaire, I'm probably a millionaire not because I work for General Electric or Walmart or whatever. I have my own business. That's why I'm a millionaire or more. And with my own business, I have expenses to pay, et cetera. And I'll offer this up right now. I have an S corporation, and I used to do consulting work, and I maintain that S corporation. For this past year, I did absolutely no work. The previous years, I did some more or other, but with my S corporation, Now, when you start getting rich and you get making money, you got employees and everything else, you need to move to a C corporation, and it's better for you. But it's just a one-person show, an S corporation works. And here's the deal. Let's say I made $100,000, which I never did with my consulting work. It was just part-time work. But let's say I made $100,000. Well, I had expenses. I had travel expenses. I flew to different locations, and those are obviously they're write-offs. They're expenses. With an
right.
S corporation, I file taxes at the end of the year, but I can't have any money left over. So any money left over then gets dispersed to myself and my wife. We're both owners of the company, and so it would be dispersed based on the number of shares I own. I have more shares than her, and so you know it's like a 60-40 split, something like that.
Right.
And so it gets dispersed. So the goal is not to have any money left over. Well, how do you do that? Well, I buy a new computer. Company pays for a new computer. They want me, to, as president of the company, to have a good computer. You know, things like I'm not going to get into all of them, but there are some things that start to get a little, you know, you would think, is that a little gray area? No, not really. What if I need health care? You know, first of all, I do have health care with my airline, but I have co-pays and other things like that. Well, my company is more than happy to, you know, reimburse for the co-pays, et cetera. They're happy to know that they don't have to pay for my entire health care. When I say they, well, it's really me. So you can see all of the expenses for things that, you know, my cell phone and on and on and on that the company pays for, that the average person that's just an employee somewhere has to pay for, and it comes out of their pocket. I'm not paying any personal income tax on it, and certainly no corporate tax because it's an S corp. It doesn't pay corporate tax. So by the end of the year, let's say I've gotten all of my expenses down to where I earned $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the fact is I made $100,000, except for the travel expenses. And typically when I do a consulting job, the company that hires me pays to fly me there and pays for a hotel. So I really don't have those costs. So in the whole scheme of things, millionaires have much more leeway to write off expenses and benefit from those expenses than the average American. So this is why I'm a proponent of the fair tax. Now, the value-added tax, let me just go back to that real quickly. The value-added tax is not just added at the end sale. So when you go to the store and buy a new dress or a television or whatever, you're going to pay a value-added tax, the value that's added to that product. But guess what? The store that purchased it first had to pay a value-added tax on it to whoever they bought it from. And
okay. And
the manufacturer of the dress had to pay a value-added tax to the company that provided the material and other things. Everybody in the whole chain of the process pays a value-added tax. Anytime something's sold, it's a value-added tax. So what you see is that multiplication, triplication, quadrification of taxation, by the time it gets to you, not only are you paying the value-added tax, but you're paying all the other value-added taxes that got piled on it before it ever got to you. So prices are much higher. This is why my relatives in Canada, you know, when they do come to visit, buy stuff here because
yeah.
It's so much cheaper here. Plus, there's not the tax, this kind of tax on it. And so that's the problem with the value-added tax. So a flat tax is one way to work it. It's just a flat tax on income. Everybody pays, you know, 10% or 15%. And we've already been down that discussion road of I absolutely believe it's immoral to have a progressive tax rate. And we're not going to get into why. If somebody wants to know, call another show. We'll talk about it. But so the real answer is a consumption tax. Now, this is what they talk about. You'll see the media talk about a consumption tax. They don't like saying the fair tax because that's the Tea Party favorite, the fair tax. It's a consumption tax. And here's how it works. No matter how much money you make, no matter how much successful your business is, et cetera, you don't pay on your income. You pay on what you consume. Now, what do rich people consume? Well, they have a Jaguar, a big mansion, you know, they got the finest home movie theater system. Guess what? Now the rich people are actually paying more taxes, much more in taxes, than they would if they were using all of their write-offs and deductions. And probably even more than a flat tax.
Luxury tax?
I'm sorry?
Is that considered a luxury tax?
No. A luxury tax is just dogpiling on whatever. We're already paying stuff, and a luxury tax is like, oh, you want to buy that yacht? Well, then we're going to add another tax on it. But you're still paying all the other taxes. If we go to a consumption tax, We would eliminate all of our income tax and every other tax. Now, the states have to earn some money, but one of the ways to incorporate the consumption tax is the state collects it, and in return for collecting it, because every time you buy something, et cetera, pay for something, you're paying that tax on it. The state collects it. Well, they get a piece of that. So that's how they get their income. And then the federal government then gets its piece. So it's a matter of deciding the amount that is being shared by the state and the federal government. But now everything that's sold, now there would be – the fair tax people say, well, you know, you can't have any exclusions. Once you start making exclusions, like, well, what about food? You know, what about poor people? Here's the thing. Poor people get a prebate, not a rebate, but a prebate up front to ensure that they aren't really paying any kind of consumption tax below a certain income level, and they can't afford food and everything else. Now, I'm not an expert on the fair tax, so I don't want anybody to call in and say, but Tom, you didn't quite get that right. Or I am not purporting to be an expert on the fair tax, but I am a proponent of it, and when I was running for Congress, the fair tax people approached me and said, will you sign a thing saying that you will vote for a fair tax and that you will support it in Congress? And I said, absolutely, yes, I will. Now, we're going to have, as I said before, Dion Long on the show on the 28th. Dion Long is an expert on the fair tax. Call in on the 28th and have all your questions for the fair tax ready, because he can answer them all. So I'm just giving you sort of a general overview. But does that make sense, Paula? There's no other taxes anymore, although the states may have some other taxes. But as far as the federal government is concerned, it'll be a set amount. And I believe right now what they say is the amount of tax that you would have to pay on everything that you buy would be 23% to make up for what we're paying now, and here's the key, paying for the current size of the federal government. Mm-hmm. You know that I'm a huge proponent of reducing the size of the federal government. Therefore, I believe that within time, we can get the fair tax amount from 23% down to about the 12, maybe even 10% range. It'll take some time, but that's what we need to do to cut the size of the government. If we cut the size of the government, then yeah, it drops. And the fair tax people have a calculation that they show you that 23% on everything you pay is actually less than what you're paying in income tax right now, even if you're in a lower income tax bracket. So I'm not going to try and get into those numbers because I haven't looked at them in a while. But Dion Long will explain all of that to us on the 28th. And, yeah, in fact, you know, do a little research on it. And if you come up with some questions, we'll quiz him on it. But he's got I guarantee he's got the answers. I've seen him speak about the fair tax way too many times. He knows what he's talking about. So that's kind of what the fair tax is. And that's – so this David Walker this morning, he went kind of the right direction when they asked him what's the solution. That is the solution. Number one, we've got to cut the size of government significantly. It is too big. It's too bloated. And as we learn from Jefferson's administration, it opens the door to too much corruption. The bigger it is, the easier it is to be corrupted, and then we pay that price. And so – reduce the size of government, and then move to either a flat tax or a consumption tax. And in my estimation, a consumption tax will actually get more money from the wealthy than a flat tax. And so for all you liberals out there, they go, oh, Tom, you're a conservative. You just want to give tax breaks to the rich. I'm telling you, they will pay a lot more under a consumption tax than they're paying today. And if you think that's conservative, a conservative view, it is a conservative view, and you need to wake up and realize that what you're purporting is to keep things where they are, just pile more taxes on the rich, which aren't going to be enough revenue to sustain the size of this government. We need to shrink the size of this government, go to consumption tax, and then here's the beauty of it. Even if you're rich, even if you're not rich, let's say, Paula, that you know you and your family have been wanting to go on a vacation. Say, well, We're gonna pay taxes on that vacation to go, and so it's gonna cost us some money. You know what? Here's what we're gonna do. We're going to not go on vacation this year. We're not gonna buy that new big screen TV. We're not gonna buy not gonna buy that. You know, maybe the refrigerator is needs some repair. We're not gonna buy a new refrigerator. We're just gonna get it repaired, and we're gonna wait another year or two. Now that flat screen TV that we really wanted is much cheaper, and maybe it just happens to be that there's an airfare war going on among the airlines and you get some good cheap tickets. So for 2 years, you didn't buy much. You didn't pay much in taxes. You had more disposable income, and it was your choice. You got to choose. Now, let's say the family's doing well and you got money and you go like, let's get that big screen TV and go on that vacation. Well, then you pay. See, it's up to you to decide. And even if you're a rich person, you can say, hey, I just made $1 million this year. I'm going to be a miser with that money. I'm going to put it in the bank. I'm going to invest it, whatever. I'm maybe going to try and build my business up. And I'm not going to buy that yacht. I'm not going to buy, my own airplane. I'm, all those kind of things. It's up to you to decide. What I see is a thriving economy under that scenario, and then people will be buying and spending because the economy is doing so much better and so many more people are employed that people are spending, and the tax revenue, I think, is going to be so much more significant than it is today in terms of, what the government is taking in. And so if we couple that with shrinking the size of government, then the government doesn't need to take in as much, and that tax rate can lower. And so I see it as a much, much better way to go, and really one of the solutions, big solutions, to our government problems. And Dion Long, that was one of his platforms. He said his two most important platform issues were the gold standard, because it stabilizes the money. And you've heard a lot probably lately, if you've been watching Squawk Box, stabilizing our currency will make a significant difference in our future economy. We need to stabilize it, have it a stable factor, and the gold standard does that. And Dion will talk about how we don't have to go completely on the gold standard. In other words, we don't have to go 100%. We can just go a percentage, but even that will help stabilize our monetary system. So anyway, there are a lot of things we need to do, but those are some of the big ones. And as far as taxation goes, and talking about taxes today on Tax Day, this is the direction we need to go. And if you don't know much about the fair tax or consumption tax or even flat tax, go online, do a little research, Google it, and you'll find some good information, learn about it, and then press your congressman, congresswoman, and senators to, push for that themselves. It's going to be a hard thing to get Congress to do it. Like I said, they're crack addicts when it comes to money and bringing in money and spending money and growing the size of government. And
right.
I know I did a little bit of a recap of a couple of days ago where we went over the people's budget, but now that the president's come out, all of the Democrats' proposals for cutting the deficit and their budget proposals are really all the same. And it boils down to, I think I've got it down to maybe the most concise statement I could say. We're going to stop going into debt at such a high rate by taking more of your money. Your money, your property is going to replace the debt we've been going into. But we're still going into debt. That's what their proposals say. And we're still going to grow the size of government more than it is. Now, Mark Levin last night he talked about an article, and I couldn't find it, and he said he was going to post it on his site. But the gentleman, and I can't even remember his name or what newspaper he was writing in, talked about, it was kind of like, I can't take it anymore. When Obama says that I inherited a $1 trillion deficit, there was no such, he did not inherit a $1 trillion deficit. So he dug into the numbers and found that what Obama was doing was saying the previous year's deficit spending under George Bush kind of spilled over, the actual spending, spilled over into his administration. In other words, it's categorized as debt under 2008, but the things that it got spent on, where the money actually got spent, so appropriated in 2008 but actually got spent in 2009, he's counting that as part of his deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and what is it that's that portion he's counting? He's counting the TARP bailout, I believe it was, that the Bush administration did, which was what, about $400 billion, somewhere around there? And then what he's doing, that was a one-time expenditure. So what Obama did was he then elevated his baseline for annual budgets by that, and then when he spent his $800-something billion, he then elevated his baseline. That's why we have a baseline. Well, remember, he said we're going to have $1 trillion deficits for years to come, because he elevated his baseline for a budget, for his budget proposals, to two one-time huge expenditures. So what he said is, we don't need bailouts anymore, but we're going to keep the government that size. And in fact, we don't need the money to go to what it went to during that time period. We're going to get to put it on all kinds of other great things. It's like he hit the jackpot at the casino, and he's going to keep getting those budgets. But now his baseline is up to $1.5 trillion. So he's grown the government from a deficit. Let's just take a look at what the government was costing and typically did cost, about $3.5 trillion. is what we were spending in the federal government.
Right.
And then with the deficits under Bush, it ranged from an extra $200 to $400 billion. So you're up to about $4 trillion. But Obama's baseline now takes what we're bringing in and spending plus his new baseline deficit to about $5.5 trillion. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge increase. So when he talks about cutting the deficit, yeah, he's going to cut the $1.5 trillion baseline for a deficit now that he has is no longer going to be just debt spending. He's going to make some of that up with our money by taking more income from us. And when he says it's just going to be on the top two brackets, he's not being truthful about that. He's going to be raising taxes on everything from capital gains, corporate taxes, and Social Security, which means a whole lot more people. You know, Social Security stops at 106,000. Once you hit that earnings point, you don't make that any. You don't pay Social Security anymore. So we've got a whole lot of people that are going to be paying taxes, higher taxes through Social Security. And we talked about this the other day. They've made no guarantees that that money is actually going to be used for Social Security. They'll just keep writing IOUs. And I believe that some of that, those IOUs, come off book. I don't know if they necessarily stay on the books as, you know, with the other deficit. I'd have to look into that. But anyways, there's a lot of, we can see a lot of accounting trickery going on, and we saw that in this most recent, budget for the to take us to the end of the year, $38 billion turning into, $300 million. And this is what's going on in Washington. Now, just to give you another example, Paul, and we haven't talked about this before, but I'm going to give you an example of why, what the kind of trickery that's going on in government. And a few years ago, when the House and Senate were both writing health care bills, you remember that the Senate bill was, or the House bill was 3,200, and I believe that the Senate bill was 3,590. Now, a House bill, when it's written, is called H.R. 3,200, House of Representatives 3,200.
Right.
And a Senate bill is what? S.B.
S.R. Is it S.R.?
No, it's S.B. It's just called Senate bill.
Senate bill,
3,590.
Okay.
Now, here's the interesting thing. The health care bill that we have right now is not SB 3590, the one that became what we call Obamacare. It's HR 3590.
I have that in front of me. Are you talking about the 3.8% home sales tax?
No, I'm talking about the government-run health care bill. The, what's the name of it? HR 3590, if you look that up. But that's the Obamacare bill that was passed both by the Senate and the House. And I'm going to type it in here, 3590. It's the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, the one that's going to cost us trillions of dollars that they lied to us about the actual cost.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so the Senate bill is called H.R. 3590. Now, how is a Senate bill called H.R., which is House of Representatives? Do you know how that works? I mean, you don't have to worry. Nobody does. I had to dig into this, and I had to ask a lot of questions to find out. It's called a shell bill. What the Senate does is it takes a bill, and here's why. Let me back up. The Constitution says that all bills that raise revenue must originate in the House of Representatives. So that means the Senate can't write a bill that taxes or raises revenue, and that's precisely what Obamacare does. So they had to take a bill that had already passed in the House of Representatives, and then what they do is, and that's why it's called a shell bill, they gut it. And the way they gut it is, they right off the bat, and I think I've got a copy of it here. I used to have a copy of it right here. Here we go. Here's the title. It says, Purpose and the Nature of a Substitute in the Senate of the United States, 111th Congress, First Session, H.R. 3590, to amend. Now, this is the title of the bill. They can't change that. And I'll tell you what they did. They can't change that, even though it's called the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Here's what the real title is. To amend the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 to modify the first-time home buying credit in the case of members of the armed forces.
Right.
They took a bill that had passed that was going to give tax relief to first-time home buying soldiers.
Right.
And they deleted everything in it. And here's how they did it. says amendment in the nature of a substitute. It's a substitute. Proposed by Mr. Reed. Here are the criminals. Mr. Reed, Mr. Baucus, Mr. Dodd, and Mr. Harkin.
Yep.
Viz, strike all after the enacting clause and insert the following. So the enacting clause is what I read to you. They can't change that, but everything after it. See, they can only amend. They can only amend House of Representative bills. They cannot then just completely rewrite them. So what they did was after the enacting clause, essentially the title, here's what they put. This act may be cited as the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. They're telling you it can be called something else other than what it was. It's still that bill that I read, the tax relief for military service members, for soldiers that have gone and fought in combat and get a tax break. I don't have a problem with that. And then it goes from there. So when they finished that bill and it went back to the House to be worked on, remember it was about 2,520 pages, something like that long?
Yes.
It was a blank bill with 2,020 pages of amendments to a blank bill, a zero-nothing bill. That's what a shell bill is, and that's what the Senate has been doing to us for years and years and years. Now, I don't recall anywhere in the Constitution where it says the Senate can do that. They've taken the liberty to do that themselves, and I think it's got to stop. The whole purpose for not allowing the Senate to write bills that raise revenue, in other words, tax us, is because it's taxation without representation. It's authored by somebody who does not represent me in my district. It's somebody who represents the state.
Right.
Senators originally represented the state. Now, they now represent the people, but how can one senator represent all the people in my state the way my representative can represent me in my district? It doesn't work the same way. So it's taxation without representation, and that was the reason why they couldn't originate bills. But we've found a way to get around that. So these are the shenanigans that our Senate and our Congress are playing with. So we've seen that now with the Obamacare bill from the Senate, you know, a year ago, and now we're seeing it with our folks in Congress with playing with numbers and telling us that they're cutting deficit, not debt, but deficit, and they're not even doing that. Anybody out there listening, check and see how your representative voted on this vote yesterday. You may not end up being too happy. So anyway, we've talked a lot about taxes. See how we're doing on time. Oh, my gosh, we're almost out of time.
We are.
Well, I guess we can save the rest for another day. Anything that you want to throw in there here at the last minute, Paula?
No, I'm good. I mean, it's good talk today again. Happy Tax Day, everyone.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. There's all kinds of, protests going on, all that stuff, and I've been to those in the past. I just, flying back today, and I didn't tell everybody. Oh, I didn't even tell you. We were driving, I told you, it's a long drive from Rio to the airport. Well, halfway there was a major crash in a tunnel that basically sealed off the tunnel. We had to turn around, go all the way back out to the beach, and then all the way around. And it took us, I think, 2 hours and 45 minutes to get to the airport. And, of course, it put us an hour and a half late. Some of the people weren't too happy. And one guy said, well, you should have left earlier. Oh, yeah, I'm Karnak the Great, and I know when there's going to be a car crash ahead of time. Second of all, I don't get paid to leave early. You know, when management tells me leave at this time, that's when I leave. Otherwise, I don't get paid any extra. And I can tell you this right now. I'm not a charity. I don't go to work and work extra hours for travelers just so that they can, have their way. No, I get paid what I get paid, and that's it. If you call American Airlines and complain to them and tell them you need to pay this guy more. So anyway, all right, we're coming to the end. Hey, thanks everybody for listening in. We will be back on Monday with Nick Taxier, I hope I say that right, and he's a political satirist. Don't miss this guy. He's very, very funny. Go to the website, usatalkradionetwork.com, to find out more about it, and we will see you on Monday. Have a great weekend. Happy Tax Day. Thanks for coming on today, Paula, and happy Tax Day, and have a great weekend.
You too.
All right. Take care, Paula.
Bye.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.